The Hard Shoulder on Newstalk.
With Nissan Subscribe and Drive. No deposit, no compromise, no fuss. Find out more at nissan.ie.
Now, many Newstalk listeners will be very familiar with Fionn Davenport. He's been a regular contributor to the station, had his own programmes on it, on this station and indeed on others. What you may not know is that Fionn, when in his 30s, discovered the truth about his birth. He was born in a mother and baby home. His young biological mother, Jane, was told that she couldn't keep her baby, and Fionn was adopted. He joins us now on the line to talk to us about this story and about recent events with regard to mother and baby homes and the current legislation. Fionn, you're very welcome.
Thanks, Mark.
Not at all. Nice to talk to you. I haven't seen you for a very long time.
It's been a while.
To be honest, I'm not surprised. I don't know why I am surprised, but I had no idea about this. I know a little bit about you, and I know people in here know a lot about you, and this came as a surprise to them.
It's a funny one. It's not something, as someone who, as you said, you know, I've obviously been on radio for many, many years. As a travel writer, I write a lot. But I've always been fairly reluctant to talk about my private life, and not because I'm ashamed of it, but because, you know, I feel like there's the private sphere and then there's the public sphere. And I've never been ashamed of the fact that I was adopted. I knew I was adopted from when I was very young or old enough to understand what adoption meant. My parents were very open with us. They explained exactly why my brother, my sister and I were all adopted. I was the eldest, or I am the eldest. But as you said, it wasn't until I was in my mid-30s that the kind of fleshing out the full story of my birth was told to me. And I had, in my late teenage years, so maybe around the age of 19, I had started being very curious about my birth mother, about the circumstances of my birth. And so I had gone into the Catholic Protection and Rescue Society of Ireland, which is where I was adopted from, on South Ann Street in Dublin. And they didn't give me any information at all. And I was told that they were precluded legally from telling me anything. So that was that. Mm. It's kind of a crazy coincidence, but a week later, I got a letter from them and said, "Listen, would you come in and have another chat with us?" And so I went in, and it found out that my birth mother had gone in for the very first time since giving me up for adoption the very next day. Now, I'm not a believer in magic or anything like that, but the coincidence freaked me out.
Can I go back to when you started getting curious, first of all? Your parents told you when they felt you were old enough to understand. And obviously they would be aware that there would be questions as you got older and possibly that you would want to go looking and would have answers. Did they have any information for you that they could give you as a kind of a starting point?
Well, I'd always operated on a version of a nice story, which was that my birth mother was very young, that she wasn't in any position to give me the kind of life that she wanted. And so reluctantly, she gave me up for adoption. And Mark, that was it. Mm. Also, as well, it's worth. So I'm born in 1968. So I was a child in the early to mid 70s when I was first told about adoption. And the pervading culture at the time was ask nothing. Both my parents were discouraged from knowing too much. It was almost as though Jane had given me up, and now in order to create a bond between me and my adopted parents, it was best that we forget everything about my birth and just begin at the age at which I was adopted, which was very, very young. I was only 3 months old or so. And so it's almost though, through almost a conspiracy of silence without actually naming it thus, but this sense of like, look, we don't know anything, so there is nowhere you can go to find anything out, so there's not much point in asking.
Yeah, the reason I asked that question is because I have an adopted brother, and my parents knew that at some stage or other he was going to ask questions, and they wanted to be prepared for it. They also wanted him to have as much information, as much of a head start as he could get if he wanted to go looking for information himself. And my mother got a kind of a folder of information together. They ran into brick walls, left, right and centre. Even though the adoption process was very easy and joyous, and He's more a member of our family than I am. So, from that point of view, he has never considered himself to be anything else other than a Cagney, and he was never interested. But she did, I know, in later life, when these scandals started to emerge, I remember she was very, very angry about the way they were fobbed off. And I was just wondering, because I know, for example, that your father, a very senior diplomat, and he would have had access to information. But even people like that were stonewalled. That was the culture of secrecy that was going on.
And it is, you're absolutely right. I mean, and it, I hasten to add that, you know, as a Davenport, my brother as a Davenport and my sister as a Davenport, there was no perceptible difference between me and any of my friends and their parents. There was no question that we were as much, we belonged to the mm-hmm. same family as, you know, as I'm sure your brother did to yours. And so in a sense, with the absence of information, the best my parents could do was to give us a loving, stable family home, giving us all the opportunities they could. And they did exactly that. But what was missing, and it wasn't until I was a teenager, was those important questions that every human being asks of themselves. And that is, where did I come from? Who did I come from? And it's only when I started to get stonewalled that was the beginning of my frustration. And it took maybe not quite 20 years, but nearly 20 years to get answers to those questions. And I hasten to add, I didn't get any answers from any official source. I got them from my birth mother, who, when I was in my mid-30s, began the process of tracing me. And we met. We had a, you know, I wrote in the piece that I wrote for the journal last week. I said, you know, reunions aren't easy, not even the easy ones. Mm-hmm. And ours was very easy. You know, there was no bitterness. There was no recrimination. There was a lot of polite exchanges of information. Warm but distant, I would say. Friendly, absolutely, with fondness. But it's only after that I realized, I started to truly understand the terrible rip that adoption actually can provoke.
Well, there's this, you know, there's the physical umbilical cord, and then there's the emotional umbilical cord. Of course, nobody sees it, but the scar from that can last longer than any physical scar. And it is very interesting. You know, we've heard all the horror stories about the mother and baby homes and what was done to the girls and how they were treated. But I think maybe the cruelest and the worst things that were done to them were the lies. And you talk about Jane, your birth mother. She had a change of heart and she wanted to keep you, but the nuns told her that it was impossible because she'd signed a document giving her up for adoption, or giving you up for adoption. Now, this was an utter despicable lie.
It was a terrible, terrible lie. So you're absolutely right. So Jane had gone to the mother and baby home, so St. Patrick's on the Navan Road in Dublin, in January of 1968. She was 6 months pregnant. She wasn't quite 20. She was still 19. In order to gain access to the home, she had to sign a paper that said that she would give up the baby when born for adoption. I was born, and days after I was born, she had a change of heart. And a nun in the home told her, well, it's too late, Jane. You can't. You're not allowed to keep the baby because you have signed this document, and it's too late. Now, only many years later did she uncovered that according to the Adoption Act of 1952, under which all adoptions were done, that consent of the birth parent is not granted until the baby is 6 months old. And to add an extra twist of horror to what is a really awful, awful lie, my own mother, my adopted mother, knew this. And after she took me home, she had to wait another 3 months. And she said it was the worst 3 months of her life as she waited for my unknown birth mother to sign this consent form. And so on the one hand, you have the authorities or the representative of the authorities, because a nun could be, you know, going on a solo run, mm-hmm. telling this awful, awful lie. And then on the other hand, you have this poor woman who's adopted this newborn baby, but is so terrified that she might lose it, that it takes months before she can start to really kind of create a bond. And I think once I found that out, and it leaves me with two very distinct issues. On the one hand, real gratitude for the life that I've had, love for my parents, love for my brother, love for my sister, and also this extraordinary sense of anger at this terrible injustice that was done to Jane.
If you've just tuned in, I'm speaking with Fionn Davenport and talking about the fact that he was born in a mother and baby home and was adopted, and the struggles that he had to find out information, meet his birth mother, and of course, much more importantly, the long-lasting, lifelong-lasting emotional effects that that has on all of the parties concerned. I would advise listeners to go to thejournal.ie. Fionn wrote a superb article about his experiences and his feelings on that and current issues. Just put in Fionn Davenport, October 23rd, and you can read it. Fionn, I want to move very quickly, and you understand this game as well as I do, because I'm up against time here. I want to move to what has happened with the signing off of the bill. And I know you and lots of others are very, very angry. I want to play devil's advocate in this instance. How are the government going to protect the rights of victims who wanted their stories told out in the open like you, while also protecting the rights of those who wish to remain anonymous? That seemed to be, it seemed to me that their hands were tied, and they had Michael D. Higgins had nothing else to do. He couldn't do anything else other than sign it.
Oh, no, no. You're absolutely right. Michael D. Higgins is bound by law to sign whatever document or whatever legislation is put in front of him, unless he feels that it's a threat to the Constitution. And this clearly isn't. However, what I find troubling, and I hasten to add that until this scandal actually emerged, I had no feelings about Roderick O'Gorman one way or the other. He's not a politician I would have been overly familiar with. However, I am left perplexed to the point of bafflement that they've rejected any suggestion of amendment put to them that would, in fact, pass a piece of legislation that would protect the anonymity of those who gave testimony to the commission under cover of anonymity, while at the same time preserving the right of those many thousands of witnesses who did give evidence to the commission who want that story to be told in the open. My second point and my second problem with this is that despite reassurances by the government that, look, we're handing over the database of 60,000 names to TUSLA so as that they won't get destroyed, and it creates a barrier between us, the people who are directly affected by the mother and baby home experience. And all of a sudden, let's say I want to get my records. I have to go to a social worker and ask permission for my records. Now, I don't know. I can't read the future. Maybe they'll give them to me. Maybe they won't.
There should be no question one way or the other.
Absolutely. And then, so again, I have questions. Why not? Why do they proceed so quickly? I know that they had this deadline of October 30th. Why not extend it? You know, when you had survivors groups that were petitioning and saying, by the love of God, will you slow down and listen to us? And they didn't. Now, it raises a bigger issue. The state is central to the work of the commission in that it's not just religious orders that were running these mother and baby homes. The state is complicit.
The optics, so, look, the reality is disgraceful, but the optics of it are even worse. And if history has taught us nothing, these things will always come out in the end. And, you know, there was an opportunity to meet it head on and say it was a horrible thing that was done. It will never happen again. We're going to do everything we possibly can to be as open and as honest as we can now in kind of direct comparison to the way things were dealt with originally. And they funked it. They dropped the ball, and they should be ashamed of themselves. Fionn, listen, thank you so much for talking. And again, I would point people to that journal article. It makes for tough reading, but good reading, and something that we should all do. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today on News Talk. That's Fionn Davenport there.